A few weeks ago, some of you know that I had the privilege to be in Bahrain for demonstrations marking 1 year of the ongoing revolution in that country. At one mm-hmm. of those demonstrations, Zainab Al-Khawaja was arrested. Zainab is one of the best-known human rights activists in Bahrain, and she's partly known for her tweeting. She tweets as Angry Arabia, and people knew that she must have been detained when she didn't tweet for about 45 minutes. Zainab's also the daughter of one of Bahrain's most prominent political prisoners, Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence for human rights work. Zainab, I'm so happy to have you with us on Women's Magazine.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you as well.
When I last saw you, you were being dragged away by police. Tell us what you were doing when you were arrested on February 12th of this year.
On February 12th, me and some other human rights activists were actually heading to the Pearl Roundabout, which to us in Bahrain has become symbolic for freedom and for our cause. We were there with the known human rights activist Nabil Rajab, head of Bahrain Center for Human Rights. And Nabil that day had decided to go with his family, including his 10-year-old daughter, Malek, and his son, who was, I think, 14 years old. And we did not expect them to shoot because we had children with us, but that's exactly what happened. They started shooting tear gas and stun grenades at us. And that's when I became on the other side of the shooting and got the opportunity to run towards Pearl Roundabout. But then I came up to where they had closed off the street, and there were officers and some military personnel there. And that's where I couldn't continue. So I stopped and started chanting against the dictator in Bahrain, Hamad.
And so you were held this time for 7 days.
Yes.
And that was, as I understand, you were ordered for 7 days interrogation. What was that like for you?
It's very important to realize that in Bahrain, most people wouldn't get the treatment that I got this time or the treatment that I got last time when I got beaten up at arrest. Mostly they would get treated much worse than I have been because the government does not really care about our rights or about our lives here. What they do care about is bad media attention, and that's why they have been more careful when it comes to my case. I know a lot of people who have made similar moves or had stood in front of riot police and had been injured. Some had been killed. So in my situation, it's very different. This time I got treated much better than the last time I was arrested. Last time I did get beaten, both in the police station and as I was being dragged away by riot police. This time, after dragging me into the riot police car, they did not beat me. They did take me to a prison. I was interrogated with, and I refused to answer any of their questions. I refused the reason that they have arrested me in the first place. Illegal gathering is not something I consider to be a crime, and that's why I did not answer any of their questions and interrogations. I was then transferred to the prison, and in the prison they did not want me to have any kind of interaction with the other political prisoners, but I was not abused during my detention.
And you mentioned that this wasn't your first time in prison. When were you arrested before, and how long were you held that time?
The last time I was arrested was a few months ago, and I was also held for about a week. But the last time I was arrested, I think they hadn't realized how much media attention, bad media attention they would get. So first they shot at me. I was sitting in a roundabout, which is called Abu Sayyaba Roundabout, and was chanting. And what happened is that at first they started shooting stun grenades and tear gas. Very close to my head, actually. And then they sprayed my face with a chemical substance. So for the next hour and a half, I could not see at all. And after that, they started beating me and punching me and dragged me to the car. And even when they took me to the police station, they were punching me to the head. And when they dragged me, they put both my hands in one handcuff. And when I was taken to the police station, they started just tightening and tightening the handcuff more and more. But, I mean, after that, it was kind of the same as this time. They took me to a prison and kept me there for a week. But because of all the media attention, because of the friends that I have in Twitter and in other places, eventually they did release me.
Yeah, so as I mentioned in my intro, you're very well known under your Twitter handle, Angry Arabia, and that, I should say, is Arabia with a Y. Don't follow Angry Arabia without the Y, because She's a very hostile person. And you have over 33,000 followers on Twitter. How did you build up such a large following?
What happened is when I first started my Twitter account was just to follow what was happening in Egypt. I was really inspired by the Egyptians and their movement there. And I never thought that I would be tweeting about what was happening here. But we were very excited about doing something similar in Bahrain. So when 14 Feb happened, I started obviously joining in the protest and going every day to Pearl Roundabout. And I just had so much to share. I felt like I wanted the world to know what was happening here. It was there were such great things happening in the time of the roundabout, and there were such great crimes happening against the people of Bahrain afterwards. So I started sharing everything on Twitter. And actually, Twitter was really great for me because in many instances, I had no idea what to do except for tweet about what I was seeing and what was happening to us. And maybe that got people interested in following me to see what was happening in Bahrain, what kind of crimes were committed against peaceful protesters, and what people in Bahrain wanted, what their demands were.
And explain for our listeners what those demands are. In our media, the conflict in Bahrain, insofar as it's covered at all, which is pretty rare, and part of the reason that I and a number of other people went to Bahrain a few weeks ago was to increase the profile of this movement in the U.S. because we don't hear very much about it. But insofar as it is covered, it's very often represented as a religious conflict, Sunni versus Shia. So how accurate is that? And can you explain why February 14th, what the significance of that date is and what the demands of the movement are?
The thing is, Bahrainis have suffered under oppression, under dictatorship for a very, very long time. The monarchy we have here has been ruling the country for 230 years. We've had revolutions and uprisings almost every 10 years in Bahrain, but they haven't been this widespread as it has been this time. And always the demands have been the same. It has never been about Sunni or Shia. It's always been about equal rights for everybody in this country. It's always been about having freedom and about having democracy, about being represented in the government. We want a government that represents the people in Bahrain, a government that acts in the interest of the Bahraini people. We don't want one family that acts in its own interest and is willing to abuse our rights to kill our children for protesting. And I mean, that's exactly what other Arabs want in the Arab Spring, or what most revolutions actually in the world are about when it comes to pro-democracy revolutions. When the revolution started here in Bahrain, we were Sunnis and Shia together in the roundabout. And the number one slogan was, Sunnis and Shias are brothers. We will not sell our country to dictators. What happened after the crackdown is that the government has been spending so much money to spread the idea around the world that what's happening in Bahrain is a sectarian civil war, if you will, or that it's about Shias trying to take over the country. It's never been about that, and it's really frustrating for people here when they feel that the government has been able to fool the media or other governments. Until today, despite everything that has happened, 1 year later, if you go around villages in Bahrain, you still see the same slogan everywhere, Sunni and Shias are brothers. We have political prisoners who are Sunni and political prisoners who are Shia. And then we also have loyalists to the government who are Sunni and Shia. So it's not really about the sectarian divide. It's always been about rights and about dignity.
A lot of people asked me when it came back whether women were participating in the demonstrations. And as I answered them, I realized that I feel like I saw less gender segregation in Bahrain than in other Arab countries that I've been in. Every demonstration I was at, I think, had at least as many women as men participating, and the women were really active and often being the ones to confront the police when they were trying to arrest someone or taking photos and tweeting right in the police's face. Talk about the role of women in Bahraini society and in the protests.
I mean, Bahraini women are very strong. Bahraini women are educated. And this revolution has just been another way to show that in Bahrain, women are leaders and women go to the front and women are courageous. And we're seeing this every day. And even if some men hadn't realized that before, they realize it now. And this is one of the things I love about this revolution, is just that it's breaking up some of the things that we had in the country before. It's making us move forward. And when it comes to women being represented as leaders, this is one of the things that have been shown in this revolution. I really feel great when I go to protest and see women on the front lines and women leading the chants, and sometimes men following them and, you know, replying the chants after them. It's really impressive, and it's really empowering to women in Bahrain and also to all Arab and Muslim women.
A lot of things were building up to February 14th, which was the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of this ongoing revolution. And the militarization on the streets on the 14th, I have to say, was just overwhelming. I mean, it was almost impossible to move. And that, in fact, was the day that I and five other of my colleagues were arrested and deported right away. So a lot of the demonstrations that were hoped for in that day weren't able to happen. But what's been happening since the 14th, and what do you see as the next 12 months of this struggle bringing?
What's been happening now is the same as was happening before, is that the protests are continuing every day. And actually, one of the things that people are protesting about now is my father's hunger strike. My father is now on the 17th day of his hunger strike. And we've been seeing a lot of protests going out in the villages, calling for the government to change what has been happening, and especially to do something about the political prisoners in Bahrain. My father's strike, I just spoke to him today, and he was telling me that his strike is not about his case alone. It's about what's happening in Bahrain, and to shed light on all the abuses that are happening in Bahrain. And I just think it's very important for the whole world to start looking at our country and to start seeing what kind of atrocities are happening here. Because as long as they're believing the PR companies that the government is paying for, we're going to be paying a bigger price here, sacrificing more to get to freedom.
And yeah, I just wanted to ask a little bit about your father's case, just really briefly. Why has he been so targeted by the government?
My father's history is that he was in exile for more than 20 years because he's a human rights activist. When we came back to Bahrain in 2001, my father straight away started working on starting the Bahrain Center for Human Rights. My father's number one goal was always to educate people about their rights, to empower people, and then also to report human rights abuses. And to the government, that's something really bad because it empowers the people and it also makes them look bad for when they commit crimes against citizens in Bahrain. So my father has been targeted for the past 10 years by the government here. He's been arrested many times. He's been beaten up on the streets many times. But this is, I guess, the final straw for the government, when after the crackdown, they came and brutally arrested him, breaking his jaw, and then taking him to prison, to a military prison, where he was in solitary confinement for 2 whole months, and where he was tortured regularly and almost on a daily basis. So basically the first reason that he's been targeted is his human rights work.
And what can people do to get more information about his case and to support him, hopefully free him?
I think the first step is, as you said, is to just get more information. And to get more information about my father, one must get more information about Bahrain in general and about the revolution here. And, I mean, we all know how to get information these days. It's the 21st century. Google, you know, you can Google my father, Google Bahrain, search websites, see what kind of information is out there. Witness Bahrain, which is you and other activists who came to Bahrain, provide a lot of really good information about what's happening here. The Bahrain Center for Human Rights has reports about all kinds of human rights abuses happening in Bahrain. And then to know about Bahrain and to know about my father and spread information about what's happening here is the number one thing people can do.
I have been speaking with Zainab Al-Khawaja, who is one of the leading human rights activists in Bahrain. Zainab, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much, and I would also like to thank you for being here for 14 Feb. I personally believe that one of the main reasons that the violence was less than what we expected was your presence here. The government seems terrified at having international activists being in the country and watching what's happening, because they're number one, the first thing on their mind is just to keep us in darkness so that the world does not know what's happening here. And that's why they don't allow reporters into the country. So I am really grateful from me and from my whole country for your being here and for your support.